The connection between the mind and the body is a subtle but powerful one. Emotional turmoil can sap your energy, reduce your efficiency, cause poor health, and of course, steal your chances for happiness. Here's Dr. Peel with some thoughts on reversing this process and restoring your vitality.
A physician I know says many of his patients have nothing wrong with them except their thoughts. He has a favorite prescription for some of them, and it's a verse from the Bible, no less. It reads, "Be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind." He finds that when his patients change the pattern of their thoughts, they actually achieve a more peaceful state of mind. And that helps to produce health and well-being. Many people can benefit from such a prescription of prayer, faith, and dynamic spiritual thinking. Here's an example. The sales manager of a large company had experienced a serious decline in both ability and energy. He had once been a man of outstanding efficiency and power, but in the last year or so, he lost his creative skill and sales were slipping badly. Two vacations brought no improvement. This man's physician recommended to the company president that his patient come to our religio-psychiatric clinic for an interview. When he arrived, he was rather indignant at being sent to a church. "This is a pretty pass," he fumed, "when they send a businessman to a preacher. I suppose you're going to pray with me and read the Bible," he said irritably. "Well, I wouldn't be surprised," I answered, "for sometimes our trouble lies in an area where prayer and the therapy of the Bible can have an important effect." He proved most sullen and uncooperative until I was finally forced to say to him, "Listen, I want to tell you bluntly that you'd better cooperate with us or you're going to be fired." "Who told you that?" he demanded. "Your boss," I replied. "In fact, he says that unless we can straighten you out, as much as he regrets it, you're through." You never saw such a stunned expression on anybody's face. "What do you think I ought to do?" he finally stammered. "A person often gets himself into the state you're in," I replied, "because the mind is filled with fear, anxiety, tension, resentment, guilt, or a combination of all of these. When these ingredients accumulate to a certain weight, the personality cannot support them any longer and gives way. Normal sources of emotional, spiritual, and intellectual power become clogged up. The person becomes bogged down by resentment, fear, or guilt. I don't know your trouble, but I suggest you think of me as a sympathetic friend with whom you can be absolutely open, and that you begin to tell me all about yourself. I emphasize the importance of concealing nothing and of emptying whatever fears, resentments, or guilt feelings might be in his mind." It was rather difficult to get him to talk, for he was essentially a decent person and had a strong sense of shame. In due course, the troubles came out. He'd committed a series of sins, and these involved him in a complicated maze of lies. He was living in fear of exposure, and all in all, it was a most pathetic mass of inner confusion. I shall never forget the way he reacted when it was all over. Standing on his feet, he began to stretch. He stood on tiptoes, reaching his fingers toward the ceiling, and then took a deep breath. "My," he said, "I feel good." It was a dramatic expression of release and relief. Then I suggested that he pray and ask God to forgive him and to fill him with peace and cleanness. "Do you mean for me to pray aloud?" he asked dubiously. "I never did that in my whole life." "Yes," I said, "it's a good practice, one that will strengthen you." It was a simple prayer, and as best as I can recall it, this is what he said. "Dear Lord, I've been an unclean man, and I'm sorry for the wrong I have done. I've poured it all out to my friend here. I now ask you to forgive me and to fill me with peace. Also, make me strong so that I will never repeat these actions. Help me to be clean again and better, lots better." He went back to his office that very day. Nothing was ever said to him, and it did not need to be, for soon he got back into stride and regained his position as one of the best sales managers in his city. Later, I met his president, who said, "I don't know what you did to Bill, but now he certainly is a ball of fire." "It wasn't me," I replied. "God did it." Every thoughtful person who has ever considered the matter realizes that doctors are right when they tell us that grudges, resentment, jealousy, vindictiveness, hate, and so on are attitudes that produce poor health. The effects of anger are among the worst. Have a fit of anger and experience for yourself that sinking feeling in the pit of your stomach, that sense of sickness. Chemical reactions in the body are set up by emotional outbursts, which in turn result in feelings of ill health. Should these continue, either violently or in a simmering state over a period of time, the general condition of the body will deteriorate. Violent negative emotions place great strain upon the heart. One doctor describes how common it is for a person's blood pressure to jump 60 points almost instantly in response to an outburst of anger. A colleague of his suffered from a heart condition and knew that he was at the mercy of anyone who could annoy him. His death, in fact, resulted from a heart attack caused by a fit of anger when he forgot to discipline himself. This doctor suggests, whenever a problem starts to vex you or you begin to get angry, let yourself go limp all over. This will dissipate your inner turmoil. In a speech to the American College of Physicians, Dr. Edward Weiss of Temple University Medical School stated that emotions and feelings are quite as real as germs and no less respectable in their power. The pain and suffering of diseases caused primarily by the emotions are no more imaginary than those caused by bacteria. For example, chronic victims of pains and aches in the muscles and joints may be suffering from nursing a smoldering grudge against someone, possibly close to them. And usually a patient is completely unconscious of his own role in developing the disease. Such persons are often suffering from a disorder of their feelings, often linked to a marital or parent-child problem. I was once told about a woman who came to her doctor complaining that her hands kept breaking out, a problem which was diagnosed as eczema. This doctor encouraged his patient to talk about herself. It turned out that she was a very rigid, unhappy person, and he encouraged her to see a psychiatrist for help. The psychiatrist saw at once that there was some irritating situation in her life that she was translating outwardly in the form of a skin rash. Thus, she was taking out on her own body the urge to scratch something or someone. The doctor finally put it to her bluntly. "What's eating you? You're peeved at something, aren't you?" He reported that she stiffened up like a ramrod and marched right out of the office, so he knew he'd been on target. A few days later, she came back. Due to the agony of the eczema, she was ready to let him help her, even if it meant she had to give up a hatred. It turned out to be a family argument about a will. This woman felt she'd been unfairly treated by a younger brother. When she got rid of her hostility and made up with her brother, the eczema vanished within 24 hours. Such cases go on and on. When people allow their emotions to get the better of them, their body responds by breaking down in small or sometimes in large and grave ways. How we think we feel physically has a definite effect on how we do feel. If your mind tells you you're tired or ill, the nerves and the muscles accept that as a fact. On the other hand, if you convince yourself that you feel refreshed and healthy, energy and well-being can also be generated. The body is designed to produce all the energy you need over an amazingly long period of time. To have good health, a person must take reasonable care of his body with proper diet, exercise, sleep, and so on. To complete the prescription, a well-balanced emotional life is also necessary. When body, mind, and spirit work harmoniously, energy is continuously replaced. The longer I live, the more I'm convinced that neither age nor circumstance needs to deprive us of energy and vitality. If you are feeling under par, I recommend that you do a very scrupulous self-analysis. Honestly ask yourself if you're harboring any ill will or resentment or grudges. And if so, cast them out. Every day and every night of your life, these feelings eat away at you. Emotional ills sap your energy, reduce your efficiency, cause poor health, and of course, they steal your chances for happiness. And yet some people still think that when the Bible tells us not to hate or get angry, it is theoretical advice. The Bible is not theoretical. It is our greatest book of wisdom. It is filled with practical advice on living and on health. Since irritation, anger, hate, and resentment have such a powerful effect on our health, what is the antidote? Obviously, the solution is to fill the mind with attitudes of goodwill, forgiveness, faith, love, and an indomitable spirit. To get you started in conquering such negative emotions, here are some practical suggestions.
1. Remember that anger is an emotion, and an emotion is always warm, even hot. To reduce an emotion, cool it. We all know that when a person gets angry, hands clench, the voice rises stridently, muscles tense, the body becomes rigid. Physically, you become poised to fight with adrenaline shooting through your body. To counter this reaction, deliberately oppose the heat of this emotion with coolness. Freeze it out. Use your will to keep your hands from clenching by holding your fingers out straight. Deliberately reduce the tone of your voice. Bring it down to a whisper. Slump in a chair or even lie down if possible. Remember, it's difficult to argue in a whisper or even get mad while lying down. 2. At the moment, it may be a bit hard to pray, but try it anyway. at least conjure up a picture of God in your mind and try to think of Him angry as you are. You can't do it, and the effort will serve to puncture your hostility. 3. Instead of counting to 10 when you feel anger mounting, try the first 10 words of the Our Father. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Say that 10 times and your anger will lose its power over you. 4. Anger is an emotion which is sometimes the accumulation of many minor irritations. These irritations, each rather small, gather force as one is added to another, finally bursting forth in a fury. To dry up the tiny drops that feed the great river of anger, make a list of everything that irritates you, no matter how inconsequential it may seem. Then make each separate irritation a special object of prayer. Get a victory over each, one at a time. Instead of destroying all of your consolidated anger, use prayer to snip away at each annoyance that feeds it. 5. When a situation occurs in which your feelings are hurt, get it straightened out as quickly as possible. Don't brood over it. Do something about it. Don't allow yourself to sulk or indulge in self-pity or mope around with resentful thoughts. If your feelings are hurt, see if you can talk to the person you're having trouble with. Try to resolve the situation right away so the incident doesn't get distorted or out of proportion. Put some spiritual iodine on the hurt by saying a prayer of love and forgiveness. 6. Allow the grievance to drain out of your mind. Go to someone you trust and pour it out until not a vestige of it remains within you. Then forget it. 7. Pray for people who hurt your feelings. Continue this until you feel the malice fading away. You may have to pray for quite a while to get this result. 8. Say this little prayer. May the love of God fill my heart. Then add this line. May the love of God for that person who has hurt me flood my soul. Pray this and mean it. Take the advice of Jesus literally when he said to forgive 70 times 7. That comes to 490 times. Before you have forgiven a person that many times, you will be free of resentment. Worry can have a devastating effect on your physical and emotional health. It stifles the flow of creative power and cripples the ability to act with confidence and clarity. But there is a remedy for overcoming fear. Here is Dr. Peel.
Reduced to its simplest form, what is worry? Basically, worry is an unhealthy and destructive mental habit. But if you're a worrier, you weren't born with the habit. You acquired it, and like any habit or acquired attitude, you can cast worry from your mind. A famous psychiatrist asserts that anxiety is the great modern plague. Professionals tell us that fear is the most disintegrating enemy of the human personality, that worry is the most subtle and destructive of all human diseases, that thousands of people are ill because of dammed up anxiety. Because these sufferers are unable to expel their anxieties, they've turned their problems inward, causing many forms of ill health. The destructive quality of worry is indicated by the word itself, which is derived from an old Anglo-Saxon word meaning to choke. If someone were to put his fingers around your throat and press hard, cutting off the flow of air and blood, it would be a dramatic demonstration of what you do to yourself by long-held and habitual worry. The worrier, so it seems, is not likely to live as long as the person who learns to overcome his worries. A study of some 450 people who lived to be 100 years of age found that the following reasons contributed to their long and contented lives. 1, they kept busy. 2, they used moderation in all things. 3, they ate lightly and simply. 4, they got a great deal of fun out of life. 5, they were early to bed and early to rise. 6, they were free from worry and fear, especially the fear of death. 7, they had serene minds and faith in God. Have you ever heard a person say, "I'm almost sick with worry," and then add with a laugh, "But I guess worry never really makes you ill"? But that is where they are wrong. Worry can make you ill. The problem is we worry not only with our minds, but with our hearts, brains, and every other part of ourselves. No matter what the cause of worry and fear, its effect can be noted in the cells, tissues, and organs. But don't be discouraged. There is a remedy that will bring you sure relief. You can overcome your worries. The first step is simply believing you can. For whatever you believe you can do, with God's help, you can do. Here, then, is a practical procedure which will help to eliminate abnormal worry from your daily life. Practice emptying the mind daily. This is a suggestion I will repeat over and over again, for it is of utmost importance. To avoid retaining worries in your mind while you sleep, this mental catharsis should be done preferably before retiring at night. The last 5 minutes before going to sleep are of extraordinary importance, for in that brief period the mind is most receptive to suggestion. It tends to absorb the last ideas that are entertained in the waking state. Then while you sleep, thoughts sink into the subconscious. This process of mind letting is important in overcoming worry because fearful thoughts can clog the mind and impede the flow of mental and spiritual power. But if such thoughts are eliminated daily, they will not accumulate. To help drain away these thoughts, you might use a process of creative imagination, in which you conceive of yourself as actually emptying your mind of all anxiety and fear. Think of the remarkable imaginative skill of small children. Watch how they respond to the game of kissing away a hurt. Imagination is not simply the use of fantasy. The word imagination comes from the idea of imaging, that is, creating images in our mind. Imagineering is the use of mental images to build factual results, and it is an astonishingly effective procedure. What you create with your imagination, whether it is an image of fear or of release from fear, may ultimately become a fact if it is held in your mind with sufficient faith. Here's one method you might use. Picture all your worry thoughts flowing out from you in the same way that water flows from a basin by removing the stopper. During this visualization, repeat the following affirmation. With God's help, I am now emptying my mind of all anxiety, all fear, all sense of insecurity. Repeat this slowly, 5 times. Then add, I believe that my mind is now emptied of all anxiety, all fear, all sense of insecurity. Repeat the statement 5 times while holding a mental picture of your mind as being emptied. Then thank God for thus freeing you from fear, and then go to sleep. When you're beginning the curative process, use this method mid-morning and mid-afternoon as well as bedtime. Go into some quiet place for 5 minutes for this purpose. Do this faithfully, and you will soon know its beneficial results. In due course, this thinking will drive out worry. I cannot emphasize enough the importance of freeing your mind from worry and fear. Fear something over a long period of time, and there is a real possibility that you may actually help bring it to pass. The Bible contains a line which is one of the most terrible statements ever made, terrible in its truth. It's this: "For the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me." Of course it will. For if you fear something continuously, you tend to create conditions in your mind that encourage its development. Faith is the one power against which fear cannot stand. Master faith, and you will automatically master fear. As the Bible also suggests, "That which I have greatly believed has come upon me." In many different ways, the Bible tells us that if we have faith, nothing is impossible. So if you shift your mind from fear to faith, you will stop creating the object of your fear and will instead create the object of your faith. In the campaign against the worry habit, here's a useful strategy. The vast tree of worry which has grown up in your personality over long years can best be handled by making it as small as possible. First, snip off the little worries and expressions of worry. For example, reduce the number of worry words in your conversation. Words may be the result of worry, but they also create worry. When a worry thought comes to mind, immediately remove it with a faith expression. For example, instead of saying, "I'm worried that I will miss the train," put the worry out of your mind with a prayer and get started a little earlier. The less worrying you do, the more likely you are to be well organized, for the uncluttered mind is systematic and better able to regulate time. A friend of mine says that every morning before he gets up, he repeats the words, "I believe," 3 times. Thus, at the day's beginning, he conditions his mind to faith, and it never leaves him. His mind accepts the conviction that by faith, he is going to overcome his problems and difficulties during the day. He starts the day with creative, positive thinking in his mind. He believes, and it is very hard to hold back the person who believes. Many people fail to overcome troubles such as worry because they allow a problem to seem complicated. It can be very useful to attack the problem with some simple technique, something that dramatizes your war against worry. One of the best techniques I've seen was developed by a man who was once a tremendous worrier. At one point, he was worrying himself into a bad state of nerves and ill health. He suffered from continual doubt about whether or not he had done or said the right thing. He was always rehashing his decisions and getting unnerved about them. I suggested that he ought to work out some simple method that would help him drop the day completely when it was over and go ahead into the future. One day, I noticed that his state of mind was improving, and I commented on it. "Oh, yes," he said, "I finally got the secret, and it has worked amazingly well." He asked me to drop into his office sometime during the close of the day, and he would show me how he had broken the worry habit. One evening I did, and he explained that he'd worked out a little ritual to perform every night before leaving his office. We picked up our hats and coats and started toward the door. By the door stood a wastebasket, and above it on the wall was a calendar. You could see only one date at a time, and that date was in large print. He said, "Now I will perform my evening ritual, the one that has helped me break the worry habit." He reached up and tore off the calendar page for that day. He rolled it into a small ball, and I watched with fascination as his fingers slowly opened and he dropped that day into the wastebasket. He then closed his eyes and his lips moved. Upon finishing his prayer, he said, "Amen. Okay, the day is over. Come on, let's go out and enjoy ourselves." As we walked down the street, I asked, "Would you mind telling me what you said in that prayer?" He laughed and said, "I don't think it is your kind of prayer." "Well, I pray something like this. Lord, you gave me this day. I didn't ask for it, but I was glad to have it. I did the best I could with it, and you helped me, and I thank you. I made some mistakes. That was when I didn't follow your advice, and I'm sorry about that. Forgive me. But I had some victories and some successes, too, and I'm very grateful for your guidance. But now, Lord, mistakes or successes, victories or defeats, the day is over, and I'm through with it. So I'm giving it back to you. Amen." Well, perhaps that isn't an orthodox prayer, but it certainly proved to be an effective one. He dramatized the finishing of the day, and he set his face to the future, expecting to do better tomorrow. When the day is over, God blacks it out by bringing down the curtain of night. This man cooperated with God's method, and his past mistakes and failures gradually lost their hold on him. He was released from the worries that accumulated from his yesterdays. His anti-worry formula is also described in these words from the Bible. "But this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forth unto those things which are before, I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus."
To help you break the worry habit, here are some practical suggestions you can start using right away. 1. Say to yourself, "Worry is a very bad mental habit. I can change any habit with God's help." 2. You can become free of worry by practicing the opposite and stronger habit of faith. With all the strength and perseverance you can command, start practicing faith. 3. How do you practice faith? Here's a good way to begin. First thing every morning before you rise, say out loud, "I believe." 4. Recite this prayer frequently. "I place this day, my life, my loved ones, my work in the Lord's hands. There is no harm in the Lord's hands, only good. Whatever happens, whatever results, if I am in the Lord's hands, it is His will, and it is good." 5. Practice saying something positive about everything. For example, don't say, "This is going to be a terrible day." Instead, affirm, "This is going to be a glorious day." Don't say, "I'll never be able to do that." Instead, Affirm with God's help, I will do that. 6. Shoot an injection of faith into all your conversations. A group of people talking pessimistically can infect every person in the group with negative feelings. But by talking up rather than down, you can drive off that depressing atmosphere and make everyone feel hopeful. 7. One reason you're a worrier is because your mind is literally saturated with thoughts of gloom, defeat, and apprehension. To counteract these, mark every passage in the Bible that speaks of faith, hope, and happiness. Commit each to memory. Say them over and over again until they saturate your subconscious mind. Then the subconscious will return to you what you have given it, namely optimism, not worry. 8. Help others cure the worry habit. In helping another to overcome worry, you get greater power over it within yourself. 9. Every day of your life, conceive of yourself as living in partnership and companionship with God. If He actually walked by your side, would you be worried and afraid? Well then, say to yourself, He is with me. For most people, happiness is perhaps the most precious commodity in the world, and yet, all too often, it eludes us. In this segment called Create Your Own Happiness, you'll discover why happiness is really a state of mind.
Once I met a man who absolutely bubbled over with radiant happiness. When I asked him his secret, he said, "Why, it's just as plain as the nose on your face. When I get up in the morning, I realize I have two choices, either to be happy or unhappy. And what do you think I do? I just choose to be happy, and that's all there is to it." Now, that may seem a superficial response, but I recall that Abraham Lincoln, who nobody could accuse of being superficial, said that people were just about as happy as they made their minds up to be. Perhaps the easiest thing in the world to find is a way of being unhappy. Just choose unhappiness. Go around telling yourself that things aren't going well, that nothing is satisfactory, and you can be quite sure of being unhappy. But say to yourself, things are going nicely, life is good, I choose happiness. And you can be quite sure of having your choice. Children are much more adept at finding happiness than most adults. The adult who can carry the spirit of a child into middle and old age is a kind of genius, for he will preserve the truly happy spirit with which God endows the young. The subtlety of Jesus Christ is remarkable, for he tells us that the way to live in this world is to have a childlike heart and mind. In other words, never get old or dull or jaded in spirit. Don't become super sophisticated. A 9-year-old was asked what makes her happy. She listed her playmates, her school, her church, and her family. That list incorporates all the elements that are important in adult life, too. Your friends and associates, your work, your place of worship, and the home circle where you find love. There you have happiness in a nutshell. And the happiest time of your life is in relation to those factors. Here are a few other things that some boys and girls said made them happy. Street lights reflected on a river, smoke rising from a chimney, the moon in the clouds, red velvet, a swallow flying, water being cut at the bow of a boat, a fast train rushing, a builder's crane lifting something heavy, looking into deep, clear water. There is something of the most sublime element of the universe expressed in these things. To become a happy person, have eyes that see romance in the commonplace, a child's heart, a clean soul, and spiritual simplicity. Unfortunately for many people, unhappiness is their most frequent state of mind. But since a fundamental desire of every human being is for that state of existence called happiness, something should be done about all this misery. So many real problems are created by life itself, difficulties over which we have little or no control. It is simply foolish to further create our own. But the truth is, by our thoughts and attitudes, we distill out of the ingredients of life either happiness or unhappiness for ourselves. We can manufacture unhappiness simply by our thinking. We do this, for example, when we habitually take on negative attitudes, such as everything is going to turn out badly, or other people are always getting what they don't deserve, or how come I never get what I want? Unhappiness is further increased when we saturate our minds with resentment, hate, fear, and worry. Well then, if we ourselves create such a large proportion of our unhappiness, how can we produce happiness instead? An incident from one of my railroad journeys may suggest an answer. One morning, a half dozen of us were shaving in the men's lounge. As always in such close quarters after a night on a train, this group of strangers was not disposed to be cheerful. There was little conversation, and that little was mostly mumbled. Then a man came in wearing a broad smile. He greeted us all with a bright good morning, but received rather unenthusiastic grunts in return. As he went about his shaving, he was humming a happy little tune. It got a bit on the nerves of some of the men, and finally one said rather sarcastically, "You certainly seem to be happy this morning. Why all the cheer?" "Yes," the man answered, "as a matter of fact, I am happy. I do feel cheerful." Then he added, "I make it a habit to be happy." That's all he said. But that simple statement is really quite profound. For happiness depends to an important degree upon the habit of mind we cultivate. The book of Proverbs, that collection of wise sayings, puts it in another way. "He that is of a merry heart hath a continual feast." Out of the happiness habit comes a happy life. And because we can cultivate a habit, we therefore have the power to create our own happiness. To develop the happiness habit, make a mental list of pleasant thoughts and pass them through your mind several times a day. If an unpleasant thought should enter your mind, immediately stop, consciously reject it, and substitute a pleasant thought. Every morning before rising, lie relaxed in bed for a few minutes. Let pictures of each happy experience you expect to have during the day pass across your mind. Savor their joy. Such thinking will help cause events to turn out that way. Do not affirm that things will not go well that day. By merely saying that, you can actually help to make it so. You will draw to yourself every factor, large and small, that will contribute to unhappy conditions. As a result, you will find yourself asking, "Why does everything go badly for me? What's the matter with everything?" Tomorrow, try this plan instead. When you rise, say out loud three times this one sentence. This is the day which the Lord hath made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Repeat it in a strong, clear voice with positive tone and emphasis. The statement, of course, is from the Bible, and it is a good cure for unhappiness. While dressing or shaving or getting breakfast, you might also say aloud a few such remarks as, I believe this is going to be a wonderful day. I believe I can successfully handle all the problems that will arise. I feel good physically, mentally, emotionally. I am grateful for all that I have had, for all that I now have, and all that I shall have. Things are not going to fall apart because God is here, and He is with me, and He will see me through. I thank God for every good thing. If you repeat these phrases and meditate on their meaning, you will change the character of your day by starting off with a positive frame of mind. And yet it is not enough to practice even such important techniques as these unless throughout the day you also base your actions upon fundamental principles of happy living. One of the most simple and basic of such principles is that of human love and goodwill. One man who truly knew happiness was a friend of mine named Ralston Young, who was once famous as Red Cap number 42 in New York City's Grand Central Station. This man carried bags for a living, but his real job was living the spirit of Christ. As he carried a person's suitcase, he tried to share a little Christian fellowship. He carefully watched a customer to see if there was any way he could give them more courage and hope. One day, he was asked to take an elderly lady down to her train. As he wheeled her into an elevator, he noticed there were tears in her eyes. He asked the Lord how he could help her, and the Lord gave him an idea. As he wheeled her off the elevator, he said with a smile, Ma'am, if you don't mind my saying so, that is a mighty pretty hat you're wearing. She looked up at him and said, Why, thank you. And I might add, he said, that sure is a pretty dress you have on. I like it so much. This appealed to her, and despite the fact that she wasn't feeling well, she brightened up and asked, Why in the world did you say those nice things to me? It's very thoughtful of you. Well, he said, I saw how unhappy you were. I saw that you were crying, and I just asked the Lord how I could help you. The Lord said, Speak to her about her hat. The dress, he added, was my own idea. When he asked her if she didn't feel well, she told him that she was in constant pain. She asked him, Do you by any chance know what it means to be in pain all the time? Ralston had an answer. Yes, ma'am, I do. A long time ago, I lost an eye, and it hurt like a hot iron day and night. But she said you seem to be happy now. How did you do it? By this time, he had her in her seat in the train, and he said, Prayer, ma'am. Just by prayer. Softly, she asked, Does prayer, just prayer, take your pain away? Well, answered Ralston, perhaps it doesn't always take it away. I can't say that it does, but it always helps to overcome it so it doesn't seem like it hurts so much. Just keep on praying, ma'am, and I'll pray for you too. Her tears were dried now, and she looked up at him with a smile, took him by the hand, and said, You've done me so much good. A year passed, and one night at the station, a young woman came to see Ralston. She said, I bring you a message from the dead. Before she died, my mother told me to find you and to tell you how much you helped her last year when you took her to the train in her wheelchair. She will always remember you, even in eternity, for you were so kind and loving and understanding. Then the young woman burst into tears and sobbed in her grief. Ralston stood quietly watching her. Then he said, Don't cry, Missy. Don't cry. You shouldn't cry. Give a prayer of thanksgiving instead. She was surprised by this response, and Ralston went on, Why, because many people have become orphans much younger than you. You had your mother a long, long time, and besides, you still have her. You will see her again. She is near to you now, and she always will be near to you. Maybe she is with us right now, the two of us, as we talk. The sobs ended and the tears dried. Ralston's kindness had the same effect on the daughter as it had on the mother. In this huge station with thousands of people passing by, the two of them felt the presence of the Divine One, he who inspired this red cap to go around in this way, spreading love. As Tolstoy said, where love is, God is. And we might add, where God and love are, there is happiness. So a fundamental principle in creating happiness is just to practice love. In my travels about the country, I have been fortunate to encounter an increasing number of genuinely happy individuals. These are people who have been practicing the kinds of techniques I'm describing to you. Recently, after finishing a lecture, a big, strapping, fine-looking man invited me to a party. Well, I must admit, from the way he described it, it didn't sound at all like my kind of party. I was hesitant, afraid I might cramp everyone's style. So I began to make excuses. Oh, don't worry, he said. This is your kind of party. You'll get the kick of your life out of it. So I went along with my buoyant friend, and he introduced me to a large group of joyous and exuberant people. I looked around for a bar, but there wasn't any. When I remarked that these people must have stopped somewhere before coming here, my host was shocked. Stopped somewhere? Why, don't you understand? These people have got the spirit all right, but not the kind of spirit you're thinking of. I'm surprised at you. Don't you realize what makes this crowd happy? It's so simple. They've found God as a living, vital, honest-to-goodness reality. Yes, they've got the spirit all right, but it isn't the kind that you get out of a bottle. They've got the spirit in their hearts. Then I saw what he meant. This wasn't a crowd of pious, stodgy people. Some were leaders of that town, business people, lawyers, doctors, teachers, and a lot of simpler folk besides. And they were having a wonderful time talking about God and doing it in the most natural manner imaginable. They were telling one another about the changes that had occurred in their lives through spiritual power. Those who have the naive notion that you can't laugh and be lighthearted when you're religious should have been in on that party. Well, I left that evening with a Bible verse running through my mind. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. That was the light that I saw on the faces of those happy people, an inner light reflected outwardly on their faces. And it came from an effervescent spiritual something that they had taken into themselves. Life means vitality, and these people obviously were getting their vitality from God. Through faith in God and in themselves, they had found the power that creates confidence and happiness.
If you want to create a little more happiness in your life, here are a few ideas. One, remember it is primarily your thoughts and attitudes that determine how happy you are. Never allow resentment, hate, fear, or worry to dominate your thoughts. Two, make it a habit to be happy. You can cultivate this habit, so you do have a choice. As the book of Proverbs says, "He that is of a merry heart hath a continual feast." 3. Practice happy thinking. Make a mental list of pleasant thoughts and pass them through your mind several times each day. If an unpleasant thought should enter your mind, immediately stop, consciously reject it, and substitute a pleasant one. 4. Each day when you arise, say this one sentence out loud. "This is the day which the Lord hath made. I will rejoice and be glad in it."